Hello, I'm Carrie Gard, and welcome to Tea Time with Tech Marketing Leaders.
I'm Carrie Gard, and welcome to Tea Time with Tech Marketing Leaders. We are live. If you're here with us today, August 3rd, 2023 at 12 p.m. Pacific time, please comment. Hello, Trevor. I see you, sir. I see you. Say hello. Let Brian and I know you're here because the beauty of being live is that we get to answer all of your beautiful questions as they come in real time. And I'll be sure to do that. Today, I'm joined with Brian Grover. Huge shout out to Trevor Van Worden, who's already here and waiting for us. He was kind enough to recommend Brian, and I'm so glad he did. Brian is a marketing consultant, writer, and content creator helping B2B tech and SaaS brands sound more human. He's put this to the test across industries ranging from MarTech, cybersecurity, healthcare, banking, insurance, legal, and probably a few more that he's forgotten when he wrote this for me. He's the co-author of the forthcoming B2B Influencer Marketing with Nick Bennett, who I'll be speaking to later. And the bi-weekly newsletter, The Creator Circle. You can usually find Brian near a stack of books and that he's trying to organize, but he's picking them up and reading instead. And if you go to his LinkedIn, you can literally see him under a stack of books. So he's not joking around in this case. Brian, yep. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Carrie. Excited to be here.
I'm so excited to have you. And yay, books! For those who don't follow Brian on LinkedIn, Brian, what are you currently reading and why on earth did you pick up that particular book?
So I'm usually bouncing between a couple of different books. They're always in different genres because like I can't keep two crime novels in line. It's just too difficult. But the book I'm reading is called Existential Physics. And I got into existentialism when I was emo, and I mean, I still am like a recovering emo kid, but like I was really that when I was 16, and it's been one of my favorite philosophies ever since. And so I saw that on the cover and I was like, I have to read it. I don't know anything about physics. My physics teacher in high school got fired halfway through the year. So, yeah, we're going to see how this goes. I get about every other word, but it's really been interesting. And it's not through lack of trying on the author's part. She's an exceptional writer whose name escapes me because she's German and German names are tough.
Fair enough. There's this other book that I'll send you, and I'm also blanking on the name of it, but it's this idea of intersectionality between two very uncommon topics. So I see some parallel drawing in your future between marketing and physics, and I look forward to those.
Oh, absolutely. Creativity starts with those weird intersections, in my opinion. So, yeah.
They do. Absolutely. What a wonderful intro between giving us a little insight into your book life and that wonderful write-up you gave to me. So thank you for doing my job for me. I appreciate you. But tell us your story, Brian, like from your own, I mean, while those were your words, in more detail, tell us your story. Sure. What do you do and how did you get there?
So it's kind of the irony never ceases to amaze me of being on, Tea Time with Tech Marketing Leaders. Usually we're talking about marketing software. And I was a computer science major when I first started in college, but I was the absolute worst programmer. I was like one of the people still left at X or Twitter or whatever it is. I was bad at it. I was really bad. So I left on what I've deemed an unintentional college sabbatical. I dropped out for a bit because of stuff going on. And when I went back, I looked down my transcript and I had straight A's in English and I had like, meh, pretty bad grades in computer science. So I was taking English classes for fun. I've always loved books and reading and writing. I'm not one of those Stephen King types that was writing stories at like 6 years old and submitting them to the New Yorker, but I've always loved it. So I was like, I'll just give this a try. And it was one semester in, I was like, okay, I just want to do this for the rest of my life. I had no idea what that meant. I knew I didn't want to be a teacher. I knew I just wanted to write. So, you know, the journalism thing I knew was really tough. But then I ended up getting a job at the Boston Globe, of all places. And I was working in sales support for the real estate team, who were just the most wonderful people at helping a really dumb college student learn how sales and marketing works. And they had the additional difficulty of selling to sellers. So to all my MarTech and sales tech friends out there, I see you, I hear you. Selling ad space to real estate agents is kind of in the same vein. So from there, it just kind of escalated. I just kept this singular focus on make a living writing. And what that ended up meaning is I ended up at a healthcare publisher writing a whole bunch of emails. I then ended up at a information management organization managing their tech stack because they also needed an email writer, and that was enough writing for me to be like, sure, I'll do that. And then I was an in-house copywriter at a process automation software company. And then with some changes, they were like, we love you, we want to keep you, but you're not going to be a writer anymore. And at that point, I was kind of working with a couple of other brands, and I was like, I'm just going to see if I can make this thing work. So I've worked with about 45 to 50 brands at this point, mostly tech, but yeah, I've seen all the horror stories, and I dream about them, unfortunately, sometimes.
Might mean we're all working a little too hard when that happens.
Yeah, but that's very true.
It's a balance between loving what we do, but then dreaming about what we do.
Exactly.
So I love this. Selling to sellers, the struggle is real. We all see you. I mean, marketing to marketers, marketing same to marketers, deal. Same deal. You also made a new category, which I totally appreciate, which is writing to live, living to write. Trevor, I feel like Brian is a rabbit pulled out of a hat here. So thank you. All the magic tricks are happening right now in this intersectionality of all of the things and the lives, the lives you have lived. In terms of what you're doing right now, which is a multitude of things, which we'll unpack in a second. What's one challenge you're currently feeling? I don't even see fate. I feel like if you're having a challenge, you're probably like deeply feeling it. What's your challenge?
I think this is something that a lot of, like, I never really understood serial entrepreneurs until I started out on kind of my own thing. And I am just involved in so many different things, and I have so many different things that I want to do. And to quote David Allen, who wrote Getting Things Done, you can do anything, but you can't do everything. And that's the struggle that I'm having right now is kind of figuring out and letting go of certain things, whether that means like I still want to keep this client relationship, but I'm going to bring in another writer to help me, and I'll still be the copy chief, and like everything will pass through me. But like figuring out where I can let go a little bit has been the biggest struggle and the biggest growth, honestly, this year, because it was just a hamster wheel. And yes, I left out one key part. Before college, I did work through high school and still entertain people today doing magic tricks. I was a stand-up card magician in high school because my parents told me to get a job. And I said, okay, this is what I'm going to do.
Oh, the intersectionality of doing what you love and finding a way to get, make money from it. I mean, at 16, like, what more could you? I did the same thing. So I was a total dark room nerd. You couldn't pull me out of the dark room if you tried. And my mom told me I need to get a job. I said, fine. And I went and got a job at a photo studio. Great. No problem.
I loved your post. Yeah, I loved your post about what you took away from, like, what you still use today from something that's completely different than, you know, your current, you know, money, whatever you're doing to put put food on the table for yourself and your family or whatever, it's, you never really leave all of those lives you've lived behind. They're just like a little bit of a part of what you're doing going forward.
Oh my gosh, it's so true. Yes. And what, and the lot, like you are living, you've lived multiple lives, but I also feel like you're, to your point, you're trying to get a bunch of things done right now that sort of coincide with all of those things you've done in the past. So give us a little bit of a taste, if you will, before we dive into our topic, of all the things that you are currently trying to get done, because it is a bit of a list of what you got going on over there.
I haven't thought about this at all. So mostly out of, you know, like denial and making sure I don't think about it.
Yes, but
right now I'm working with 3 different clients on their website, helping create lead magnets and kind of meatier, longer form pieces of content for a couple more clients. I'm helping kind of launch a top-down content-led sales motion with a partner, which there'll be more to come about that in the weeks to come. But that's going to be more of a larger initiative. And then on top of all that, I was like, sure, I'll write a book with you, Nick. Nick Bennett and I are writing a book on top of all of that. And yeah, my word debt is high these days. I might get downgraded in the same way the United States did.
It's not true. I do have a question for you about writing. Sure. It sort of dawned on me today. Mm-hmm. And now that I'm sitting here with you, I was like, oh, I have like the perfect person to answer this question for me. So I have found it curious that in our life of growing up through middle school, high school, and even into university or college, depending on where you are in the world, how you say that thing, we are taught to have a wide vocabulary and to come up with different words for different things. And while I find that helpful in my general writing when I'm trying to write deep and extensive, which is unusual, I don't do that as much as often as I'd like to. Mm-hmm. But I have found it to, from a marketing standpoint, to sort of bite me in the butt lately in my inability to be consistent in my language. Sure. So as a marketer and a writer who's lived multiple lives through all of these things, who's also does in-depth versus the lead magnets, thank you, Trevor, yes to those. Can you help me, Brian? Like, is there a balance between when to be consistent with our words and when we can get creative?
I think kind of what you're asking here, Carrie, is about jargon and stuff like that. And like where that conversation is very tough. It's being consistent with labeling things and using language isn't really our choice as writers. It's what our audience is expecting to see. So I'm trying to think of an example. I think that, weird words are the best thing to do. My favorite one to drop is solipsism. And I'll define that later. So with jargon and like trying to use the right words consistently, language is always evolving. We've seen that happen live with the way that Zoom and Slack became a verb. Like, you know, in marketing communities, you can drop those terms and everybody knows what you mean. So it's hard to know what is the right word to use, but the correct word to use is the one that will resonate with your audience, is my kind of roundabout answer for that. So sometimes it's not the word we want to use. And to give an allegory, or not an allegory, a reference point for that, like I'm a reader, obviously. That's how I consume content. But a lot of the people that I'm looking to reach, the marketing leaders, the content marketing managers that I'm looking to reach and help with their content strategy, they prefer video or audio. So I had to, I mean, this has already been so enjoyable. So I realized the hole that I've dug for myself here. But I had to, you know, come outside of my comfort zone and talk with people in a different way than I'm used to communicating, because I am far more concise in writing than I am in talking. I think that answers your question.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's interesting because you don't want to use jargon, but you want to, like, the industry sort of has defined a certain vocabulary, depending on which industry you're looking at. There is a vocabulary that you need to use, and you need to be consistent about what that vocabulary is. Not necessarily in all the, there is always jargon, and it's a balancing act for sure. But I find I keep confusing people because I use certain things interchangeably. And there are certain times where I need to really, like, pick the word and stick to it. And it's coming up from the world of wanting a wide vocabulary is tricky. So I appreciate you reminding us to come back to our audience and who we're speaking to and making that matter. Trevor is having a whale of a time over here with his vocabulary, and I'm here for it. So thank you, Trevor.
Eschew is a really fun one to say. Actually, my favorite word to say is smock. Smock is it. It's just a fun word to say. It just has a to it.
Oh my gosh, we'll just have to come up with our own list of just fun words to say on a basis. And it is different. I love what you're saying too. It not only does it matter, and this is going to lend nicely to our conversation, not only does it matter in terms of how you write it, but also what you say. Like, Philly is a much more funny, is a super fun word to say, but not necessarily something that would work in a sentence of writing it. So yes to the medium as well. And I love that. Yes, Trevor, these people should be joining us. Mike Phelps, get over here. Peter Wheeler, come on, man. What a great conversation we're about to have. And these folks can definitely lend their expertise to it. So I'm here for those comments of what they're going to drop to us and the questions they're going to have to answer. It's going to be great. Brian, speaking of our conversation, this is a really important one. I think needs to happen right now because people are trying to figure out. I just had a wonderful conversation with Frida on, she asked a really important question around what can we do right now in the really tricky world that we live in regards to marketing budgets being cut, but then expecting us to, like, grow businesses. And I feel like this is an amazing channel that's been underrated for a long time because it's kind of gotten like the consumer rap or the really big name rap, but what you're about to bring to the table is about to blow all of that wide open. So in terms of what influencer marketing means to you and your experience, define that for us.
To me, influencer marketing is partnering with someone that has an established brand and audience. And this gets back to our precision of language thing, borrowing that trust and authority by aligning with them. And I use the word aligning and I use the word borrowing because it's obviously not something that they can give. And aligning, it is a collaboration. And that's kind of what sets influencer marketing today out from what it used to be in B2B and where B2C is still playing around in that area. It's definitely still a growing field, which is why it's been so exciting working on this book with Nick and talking with people on both sides of the equation, people that are building these sorts of programs while also talking with creators that are like, this is what I'm looking for brands to do in order for me to work better with them.
When I think of influencers, this may date me a little bit, or maybe I've been watching way too much Emily in Paris, but when I think of influencers, I think of Instagrammers and YouTubers who have product placement sort of built into their everyday that they sort of like, look at this beautiful makeup I'm wearing or this purse I'm carrying or like, you know, so they sort of build it into their persona as they show up in the world on these channels. But that doesn't translate to B2B in the same way. Mm-hmm. So from a B2B perspective, like, how do these influencers show up when it comes to partnering with a brand?
So one of my favorite headings, this is a weird sentence, but one of my favorite headings in the book so far is content is still king. It's just a different kind of content. And that's kind of what it comes down to, is finding influencers that align with your brand's, like truly align with your brand's values. Like they are, like in my, let's use me as an example. Like my whole shtick around content marketing is making it more human. If you are an established enterprise that is going to play it safe, that is never going to kind of take a side on anything, it's going to try to talk to everyone, which there's nothing wrong with that when you have the budget to back that up, that you can just blast everybody.
Right.
But I'm not, I wouldn't be the best content creator for them, because irreverence is kind of my whole deal. And I would make certain, you know, Microsoft executives just, they would be just like, oh, why did you have to bring up the movie Jaws when we were talking about, we were talking about laptops and you brought up the movie Jaws.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an example of bad alignment. But I think that's kind of where I lost my train of thought right there.
No, yep. I think that's a good example of what not to do when finding an influencer, and what the point you're trying to make is, when you're finding an influencer, you want to partner with somebody, or generally a person, correct? Somebody with some sort of community. You want to partner with somebody who aligns to your brand and is going to help you further that into their own community. And the Microsoft DeBry example is what not to do.
Yes. Now that I've gotten the train back on track, thank you, Carrie.
I got you.
Great hosting. So yeah, it's where B2C is right now. It's to use that whole Forrester Gartner maturity curve thing, it's very mature in B2C. You can go to, if you are a B2C brand, you can go to a marketplace and literally be like, oh, this person's audience looks like this and they do this kind of content. That's who I want to work with. Right now, a lot of the creators that I've talked to at the B2B space, they're like, it's kind of touch and go. It's a little bit different. And so what we're hoping this book will start the conversation around is providing a bit more of a framework and kind of stripping away the negative connotation of like influencer marketing equals Chuck Norris using the Total Gym at 3 a.m. That's what I think of, is Chuck Norris.
I mean, Chuck Norris, Emily Paris, that's like the best dichotomy ever. So thank you for that. Can you give us a few examples? I have a few if you need a kickstart, but like a few examples of some B2B influencers that are sort of, not necessarily who we're talking about for this conversation, but to give our audience a baseline of some really great influencers out there in the space, in the B2B market, that fit this.
Oh, absolutely. And it's all the people that I've been talking to. I mean, obviously, he's going to see me next week at a conference. So if I don't say Nick up top, hi Nick, if you're in the audience here. But Nick's whole deal and why we really hit it off is his authenticity that he brings to every company that he's worked with as an evangelist, and that's kind of the reason why they brought him in. Yes, it was his expertise in field marketing, and then eventually his expertise in influencer marketing and the like, from, you know, Alice and Airmeet and the like. Karina Owens was another like exceptional conversation that I had. Tim Davidson, the list goes on. Will Aitken over at Lavender. I think that what all of these people have in common is pretty simple. They have a viewpoint, and it's not to say that they refuse to change their minds or anything like that, but when you go and you follow any of these influencers I mentioned, and we've talked to 20-ish so far, not counting the ones that we've gotten text answers from, the thing that ties them all together is they believe in what they're saying on a particular topic. Oh, there you are, Nick. So they believe in what they're saying on a particular topic and they stand by it. And that's why they're trustworthy, is because, you know, in politics, think of the politician that's called the flip-flopper. It's a negative thing, because it's not that they changed their mind on a topic. It's just that they are aligned with whichever way the wind blows. And that's where a lot of people see brands sometimes, especially these big faceless enterprises where it's like, oh, June 1st, it's LGBTQIA, rainbows everywhere. And it's like, but didn't you donate to... Never mind. But it's a lack of authenticity, and we can see right through it. But with a talented influencer, whether B2B or B2C, it's that authenticity and showing up as themselves and having a viewpoint.
I love that. There's the big names too. There's the Gary V's of the world. There's the Exit Five, David Earhart. There's definitely the big names, but I love how you're calling attention to the folks who've cultivated the intentional audiences, not the masses. And that leads perfectly into where we're going to sit today. Out of curiosity, you called Nick Bennett an influencer. Do you consider yourself an influencer?
I'm an influencer only for what people are reading, from what I've been told. I aspire to helping people see like what I'm working on and how that's affected me. But there's this book that I read. It's one of my favorites. It's called If You Meet the Buddha on the Road, Kill Him. Bit of a violent title, but I promise it's not content-wise. But the core thesis of that book is that there's no person that can tell you this is exactly how you should do anything. And if anyone says to you, oh, I know exactly what you need to do, this is what you need to do, they can only tell you what they have done and what has worked for them. So in a way, anybody who is speaking their viewpoint on LinkedIn or any social media network and giving their view on any subject is doing just that and influencing. And what it all comes back to is trust. And, you know, the trust that you've built up with that audience, whether you have 1,000 followers or 1,000,000, there's a degree of trust that's being lent from your audience that if they say, like, adopt my framework for LinkedIn riches. That's usually the quickest way to burn trust. Another not to do that, or come out with an AI course.
That's a big AI, right now.
When generative AI is, you know, if we consider November of last year to be the epoch of when it really exploded. I mean, there's been brands around doing that stuff for years, but I digress.
It's a good point though, because if it takes 10,000 hours to be an expert in anything, AI included, and AI's only been out for the last 6 months, can you really be an expert in it just yet?
Yeah, it's
probably not.
I think that comes back to the authenticity thing where, you know, my stance on AI and how I've talked about it has either been making fun of it, because that's just what I do. I've made so many 2001 A Space Odyssey references that I don't know what to do with it. Terminator, etc. Like every AI movie I can think of, I've made that joke. But the other thing is, hey, this is what's worked for me. And like, you know, one of the things, I'm a content writer, but yes, I'm using AI for making up for one of my shortcomings, and that's editing. Because of working with so many different brands at the same time and often on quick turnarounds and stuff, sometimes I will rewrite a sentence so many times and in my brain it reads perfect.
Yeah.
But that's usually going to be the Google Doc comment that I get at, you know, 10 p.m. when this poor overworked marketing manager finally has time to read the draft.
Oh, no. Yeah.
So I will often feed portions of a blog post in and just be like, hey, check for these things. And that has helped me. And I've been sharing that with people. But saying I can help you make $100,000 is just, people are more skeptical than ever. And trust is so easily lost.
I could talk about AI and machine learning because I also curate. Like, I just adopted Grammarly for the first time ever in the history of my life. Considering I am the worst, like my teachers always told me how much they loved working with me, but the one feedback they all gave me through my entire since I could start writing was, "But your grammar and spelling need work." Like, even in one of my jobs right before I started MKG was that my boss, one of the feedback he gave me was spelling and grammar. So to this day, the struggle is real. And so I adopted Grammarly, which is probably, I would say, more machine learning than AI. Mm-hmm. So I find it interesting that you're feeding it into an AI to get feedback on that. I also love, I just want to call her out because I absolutely love her posts. Melissa Moody is on this Midjourney journey, and she's sharing it in a really lovely, authentic way, and the way that you're talking about it, Brian, of like, here's what's working for me. And they're gorgeous. Like, it's so inspiring and it makes me want to go figure it out, but also I don't have the time. But like, you go, Melissa. Yes. That. I think that's also a really great way to show up in the world to your community and say, here's what I've got going on and here's what I'm trying to figure out. And I'm not an expert in this, and that's okay.
Yes.
But man, she looks like it. I gotta say, she's really hacking the system over there.
If there's one thing AI is really good at, it's making us look better. So like, I feel like we're only like 20 years removed from, you know, someone at the Academy Awards being like, "I'd like to thank ChatGPT. Your tips were invaluable for this best supporting actor." Someday we'll see.
Someday. It's kind of, I mean, I think it's going to be here faster than we can imagine. So just buckle up, y'all. Buckle
up. Next week. Getting on
the office. In terms of activating an influencer community, so getting a bit more into the tactics here, because I think we've defined influencer to the nth degree, and everybody's like, okay, I get it. Like, can we move along? I hear you all. I'm abiding. I think when it comes to, there's two ways to go about this. Either you can become an influencer or you can activate an influencer community. And what we're talking about is finding those influencers to partner with. And I love one of Trevor's questions. Trevor, I see you. I'm coming back to you about holding them accountable. We'll get there.
Yep.
But in terms of creating an influencer marketing program as a channel, like I said, I think people need this right now because budgets are being cut and being held back and we still have to grow. And B2B has become so people to people in terms of how they buy. It is so word of mouth. It is so trust-based, as you mentioned. And influencers are a really great way to activate that authentically. I'm sure there's some boundaries we need to balance here as we get into the conversation. But let's just like kick this off in terms of your approach to building influencer marketing as its own channel. Where do you start?
I just want to preface this with a disclaimer that I have, you know, done all of the things in marketing and worked alongside influencer marketing programs, even though we didn't call them that because it just, it was even more in its infancy 4 years ago. But these have been insights gleaned from all of the people that have led to us being able to write a book in the first place. So, you know, I will cite their names as appropriate once the book comes out, but I just want to say that up top, this is not my this is not my original thinking. This is kind of distilling what I've heard down into kind of a short conversation. So I would say the most important thing, and this goes for literally any campaign that you're looking to launch, you need to understand what your business objective is. Like, what are you trying to do? Because that's going to determine everything else that's going on. Like, if your goal is qualified pipeline and you're going to work with an influencer for 3 months, but your buying cycle is 18 months, you're going to have a bad time. If you want brand awareness and you are going to work with 5 influencers who have 11 followers apiece, you're going to have a bad time. So starting out with a really clear understanding of what the business objective is, what does this look like ideally? What is our audience looking for? Really, you know, circling the wagons for everybody that's going to be involved, and making this cross-functional is really important, because again, this is kind of general marketing campaign stuff, but these things can get really complicated really fast. So having the right people involved at the beginning is vital.
One thing I want to hook on that you said, Brian, that I think is really important to all campaign marketing efforts right now. And I speak from a right now standpoint, because it's just such an interesting time that we're in, that while we're recommending influencer marketing, it is not the end all and be all and the only thing you should be doing. There needs to be a holistic approach to how you support the program in other ways outside of the one thing.
Absolutely. Influencer marketing is an amplification effort. If your fundamentals are askew, if you don't have problem product fit, product market fit, any of the fits, it's not going to work. If you're trying to get involved with influencers, but at the same time you're trying to like spin up a PLG motion, again, and it's one of my favorite episodes of South Park, you're gonna have a bad time. So don't pizza when you're supposed to French fry. Anyway, so once you have your business objective figured out, then comes the question of, like, what's your budget look like? And your budget is going to inform a couple of things, of whether it's going to be kind of a grassroots type of program, whether it's going to be like you literally reaching out to people that you know are influencers within the community, and just it might just be like, hey, would love for you to check this out. And I haven't done a good job with the compliance stuff, sorry Nick, so I don't have the NDA, but there's a certain baked goods company that we spoke to, Grove Cookie Company. Grayson was gracious enough to give us his time and expertise on how he had started it. And it was very genuine and very one-to-one outreach and starting from a place of giving. So that's the low budget, scrappy way to do this. If you have some dollars to put behind it, what I heard time and again was to kind of collaborate with a small pool, starting as small as possible, a small pool of people that had anywhere from 1 to 5,000 followers. It doesn't need to be the Gary V's. It doesn't need to be the Kim Kardashians, or you don't need Taylor Swift to, like, you know, hold up a laptop.
A dream.
Yeah, right. I mean, at this point, being a truck driver for Taylor Swift seems like hey, there's
a good way to.
Yeah, it's a way to make a living. I mean, you do have to be away from your family for 24 weeks. There's that. But
influencer. Oh my gosh. Anyway, we digress. We talk about Taylor all day and the beauty of how she's built community.
Oh yeah. So you know, if you've got a little budget to put behind it, what you're going to want to do is identify key people that have the following, and this is probably going to take the most research to really dig into those Slack communities. dig into those forums if they still exist, dig into those dig into those places on LinkedIn, those groups, Facebook groups, whatever, and finding those people that are leading the conversation and reaching out to them and starting a conversation. As you move up in the number of followers, the maturity level of the person that you're going to be working with is going to be a bit different. They're going to be understanding their value a little bit more. They're going to know what they're doing, and they probably will lead you a little bit more. But if we're talking limited budgets, you might be working with people that have never been approached for a brand deal before.
I gotta say, I find those folks, Peter Wheeler calls them referral friends, and they truly are like the best friends around. If you can find those folks who are more kicking off in their influencer career, like, man, friends for life right there in terms of, because I don't, you know, you don't really know how big your audience really is unless you're Gary Vee. And so, you know, it's almost more intentional, right? If you're talking to, if you have one person you're talking to who has a few friends who fit like what you're trying to do, and there's a good fit there, like that goes way further, I find, in terms of trust and relationship building than trying to get the big guns out.
Absolutely. And this, and I would take the, you know, 15 to 20 micro or nano influencers over the mega influencers any day. And that's because there's going to be so much focus on what value they're providing. They've hit their stride. They've got their content down and they really understand what's going on. But at the same time, like, I hate to quantify people like this, but at the same time, they're earlier on in their influencer career, and you can make things work that it's beneficial to both parties.
Yes.
Working on a budget. You know, like, every single influencer that I talk to remembers their first deal and they underpriced themselves and like all of that. But like, it was the ones that went well, where the brand was really like the brand and the marketing team behind the brand really paid attention to like wanting to make it a collaborative experience. They remember that fondly. And like, at the end of the day, it's almost like the customer experience sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Where it's like, if you give a good experience, people will like, I believe it's Maya Angelou, that like, people may not remember what you say or what you do, but they'll always remember how you made them feel. And that's another thing to keep in mind as you're kind of thinking about building an influencer marketing program. But we've talked a lot about the partnering aspect of it. We've also seen, Lavender is a really, really clear example of this, where they brought a stable of really, really strong creators that aligned with their brand in-house as employees, and have kind of lassoed them and gone along for the ride. And they have a mutual trust for some of the antics that these extremely, extremely talented creators get up to. But they knew what they signed up for, and they knew that that was the vibe that they wanted their brand to give off. And it's important to remember that, like, at the end of the day, like, as you're looking to set up an influencer marketing program, you should be working with people that you would hire and you would let go to a trade show and walk around with their, like, your name on their badge and represent you. If you can't imagine yourself doing that and you just want to align with someone with a huge following, you're going to have a bad time.
I love that. Such a great point. Chris Cochran's doing this with Huntress, and I just love watching him walk around and be on screen with like Huntress gear on, like, yes, go Chris, go. And Huntress is a great brand. Like, what an amazing alignment. I bring that up a lot. I'm sorry, folks, but like, I can't get over how perfect of a marriage that is. So that's another great example of when to bring an influencer in. I love that Lavender. I didn't know that Lavender did that. And like, that's that means, I imagine there was pretty good, like, there was good intention behind that. There was also pretty good money behind that, right? If you're going to hire a few influencers, you're going to have a strong budget. And what other sort of programs have you seen in terms of, like, I would say we've talked a lot about the smaller budgets in terms of grassroots and partnership. Lavender is a good example of if you got a good budget. What about the more in between? Where have you seen some good examples of like activating influencers when you have like a little bit, but you don't have like the whole kit and caboodle?
So this is, there's one method that I've seen pop up a couple of times, and that's just been through Empowering. If you've got employees already working for your organization and organically talking about the things that they're doing at work and championing your brand because they're excited to work for your company.
Yes.
Give those people the right platform, the right support. The network effect is real if you can get a whole bunch of people within your organization to be talking about that with their network. And, you know, if they're, let's use one of my other past lives in marketing operations as an example. If I'm a marketing operations professional working for, you know, insert brand here, I'm going to be connected with other marketing ops professionals and be talking about the same things. And let's say, you know, this marketing ops professional is at a MarTech platform. They're connected with your ideal audience. And if they have a flair for, you know, it's not a flair for controversy, but like we said, of taking a position on something and being like, you know what? The Godfather Part 3 is not that bad of a movie. It's just not as good as the first two. And, you know, like just giving people the leeway to do that.
It kind of needs to be a no holds bar. Like if you're going to bring people in to be a advocate for your brand and they're going to bring their whole selves to the occasion, you can't filter them. Right. You lose the authenticity of that.
Exactly. And it comes, there's two words that have come up time and time and time and time again, and that's trust and audience. Understanding what your audience is looking for, and then understanding that trust exists at all of the levels. There's the trust that you might be borrowing from the influencer, but there's also the trust that the brand and the influencer have between them of like, we're going to give you an idea of a type of content series that we'd like to tackle. How would you go about that? As opposed to just considering them an order taker and being like, hey, we want you to post this sponsored post. Here's the copy. But anyone that's been creating, like, just taking from a text perspective, anyone that's creating written content, they have a unique style. You know, my copywriting career was informed by direct response, which is much more kind of, okay, it can be categorized as broetry because of the line breaks, but it makes it easier to read and it's not big paragraph, but I'll throw myself under the bus there. But but like my style is informed by that. But before, my style was informed by academia. I was an English major. Like I wrote really long, complex sentences that just went on forever. And like that was my voice at the time. And if someone handed the academic version of me the modern way that I write, I would have said that's not me, and vice versa. I've struggled with that with clients from time to time when I've gotten like drafts of stuff and I've completely reworked it to my voice, and I didn't do that sensitive to the fact that it was their voice. And that was a really fun learning opportunity.
Well, I mean, that's a whole different topic.
Yeah.
So you'll just have to come back on, Brian. It's going to be great. But I do think that, you know, influencer and content writers go hand in hand, right? Like you have to find writer. If you're going to outsource your writing, then you have to find writers who fit your tone already, because trying to ask writers to magically work in the way that you do goes against pretty much every bone in your body.
Yeah, and voice is adaptable, but at the same time, like, if the influencer's voice changes, it immediately sends up a you know, it puts our like our hackles are raised that this is not authentic content.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would say that's like the last kind of in between, which is kind of identifying if there's someone in house that you can elevate from within.
Yes. I'm all about elevating from within. I think that's magical. Mm-hmm. So what I heard you say is first you got to define your business objective, make sure that this is going to work for what you're trying to accomplish. Mm-hmm. And make sure you have the right budget to back it up, depending on how, you know, do you have long-term or short-term goals? If you have short-term goals, you probably want to put a little oomph behind it. If you have long-term goals, man, go grassroots and build a unique audience with the right, you know, style, and the right folks that you want to get involved. In terms of the types of programs, things that you mentioned was anywhere from hiring internally like Lavender to going out and partnering with audiences that are kind of small and getting, you know, getting their feet under them and how to support them and find like a two-way street sort of mentality, to, you know, bringing in evangelists to really go out there and speak about your brand and dazzle them in all of the swag and all of the land. you've mentioned how to find the influencers from going out on LinkedIn to scouring the Slack channels of the world and the groups and finding the biggest voices in those networks, in those small communities, make it happen, make it so. And the one two things we didn't touch on that I think is really important and something that marketers are really struggling with today is how to know it's working. Like, influencer to me means brand building and not necessarily that see it like you click it mentality. So in your experience or from the conversations you've been having as you write this book, what does measurement look like in the world of building an influencer program?
So there's kind of two buckets. There's using numbers to quantify fit for an influencer. Regardless of the type of program you're looking to build. And that might be those things like reach, impression, engagements, DMs from, you know, a direct call to action. Those are the quantifiable things, but this is why the direct port from B2C to B2B is a bit of a struggle, because the B2B world for the last, I want to say 15 plus years, has been so hyper-focused on measurement in a clinical, like, just quantifiable way. And I think that that's going to be the biggest growing pain, because I think there's going to be indicators that you can leverage as your influencer program is underway. Like let's say you partner with a smaller podcast and you sponsor that podcast and you've got a mid-roll, whatever. If you start to see traffic building up over time as the listenership of that podcast increases, I think that you can make a clear line to, you might not be able to calculate 4.7% ROI, 4.7x ROI, but you can say, hey, board, this is working and we'd like to add more oomph behind this, because
it's
look,
an indicator.
Yeah, it's just looking at that. Brand sentiment is another thing. There's plenty of tools in social media that you can use to monitor how people are talking about your brand. Dark social.
I haven't heard that. Sorry, I got to sit there for a second because I haven't heard that word sentiment and tools around measuring sentiment in so long. I don't know if it's because I'm outside of like the social media organic world. I know that it's very prevalent there, but like, wow, did that bring me back? And I think that's such, I think we're going to see a shift towards brand in general.
Yeah.
In thanks to AI and way Google's going and some other things. And so mm-hmm. I think, yeah, like measuring sentiment should be something we look at again.
Absolutely. Yeah, especially keeping in mind that like dark social is only dark if you don't light up the corners that you know your audience is spending time in. If you mm-hmm. aren't sure, like if everything's falling under direct, which is every marketer's favorite bucket of traffic, it's not that those people just spontaneous, like it's not like these buyers are grown in a, you know, locker room floor somewhere, like, and they're just like, I need software. It's just that you're filling in pieces of the puzzle and you will never have the whole puzzle completed, but you can't have enough of the puzzle completed to make things repeatable and scalable. And that's where I think brand sentiment comes in, is that once you start to get this program up and running and you're using, you know, self-reported attribution on form fills, or, you know, one of the tools we just mentioned, or training your SDRs, BDRs, or sales reps to just straight up ask, hey, did you hear about us and stuff like that? Mm-hmm. That's where you can then iterate and show value, even if it's not in the same traditional way. And it's just sort of like how we talked at the beginning about how everything with language is always shifting. With marketing, it shifts even quicker. I mean, Threads has lost 70% of its active daily users.
Has it really?
Yeah.
I didn't realize it was that big. So, 70%.
Well, right. But that doesn't, like, over time, that's just going to be an outlier. And they mm-hmm. will be able to measure that more effectively over time. And I think that that's where the influencer marketing measurement comes in, is that it's going to be, no matter whether you're just going to go with a Gary V versus a me, for instance, you're going to need to give both of those things some time. And the mm-hmm. best influencer marketing relationships you're going to have are going to be long-term relationships. They're not going to be transactional. They're not going to be, hey, send this post out for me.
Last question, because Trevor asked it early on, and I think this lends itself to closing us out here. He asked about accountability in terms of mm-hmm. how you hold. The trouble with B2B influencer marketing is counting on them to do a good job, continuously attracting that audience once they affiliate with your brand. So to your point that you just made, Brian, is it really come back to relationship building that naturally holds them accountable, or is there something bigger that needs to be done?
My business as it exists today, you know, I'm a solo marketing content writer dude. It wouldn't exist without relationships. And case in point, I bought a new book, believe it or not, and I thought of a client that I had last year, and I sent that book to her, and I was just like, hey, hope you're well, was thinking of you, sent it apropos of nothing, and she was like, oh, this is so sweet of you, thank you. Also, we might have some projects coming up. So it's a lot of giving without the expectation of getting anything in return, and it's just like it's the more transactional you make the relationship between you and the influencer, the less accountable they're going to feel, because it's just going to come down to that paycheck, which is lovely, but extrinsic motivation hits its limit at a certain point. And so I think if you build a genuine connection with the influencer or influencers you're collaborating with, and they're doing something that's exciting while also building their own brand in alignment with yours, and you're getting qualified pipeline because you're reaching the audience that you're looking to, like, you're looking to reach, everybody wins. And that's how everyone wants to just keep going.
Yeah. The last thing I'll say on this, and then I know we got to wrap, man, could I talk to you forever. The last thing I'm going to say, because I know my clients are running into this a whole lot, is this feels like a real, true, genuine program people could stand up to get boots on the ground as a people-to-people sales motion that really needs to be taken into account these days. I feel like everybody needs to be doing some level of influencer, whether you're becoming the influencer and going out and creating relationships one-to-one, or whether you're activating, yes, Trevor, do what moves you, or whether you're activating multiple influencers around a common cause. Having a people-to-people movement is really what's going to build your brand in the long run. And community-led growth, let's go. Community-led growth, I'm here for it. yes, Trevor, all the things, all the acronyms, all day long.
I'm still waiting on growth-led growth.
Growth-led growth.
You grow.
Somebody's going to build the category now.
Yeah.
A new category. There it is. There it is. Oh, my gosh. Category pirates. Let's go. I got to wrap up here, right? Seriously, all day. I could just hang out with you all day. This is amazing. I got to wrap this up. And the way I love to wrap this up is with my people first question, because you're more than the content writer and the marketer that you are, clearly, from everything you've already shared with us and how open you've been. But I have to know, given boats are clearly a theme for you right now, you got with your LinkedIn posts from Broadway shows about Jaws to writing on the beach and setting sail on a regular basis, pictures with you and Nick on the water. I have to know, if you didn't have to go by boat, that would take an eternity. I love boating, but it's slow. I know from experience. If you could go anywhere in the world without any challenges in your way, where would you go and why? Like, what's on your bucket list? Where do you want to go?
Oh, that's easy. Paris, the West Bank. I mean, I end up getting sucked into different epics of epochs of time. And the 1920s in Paris is one of them. The Italian Renaissance in Florence is another. The American Revolution in Boston, because Boston, well, of course. But the 1920s, it's just this perfect storm of romanticism, creativity, and just feeling lost, while also trying to create something new with Hemingway, Stein, Fitzgerald, that whole crew. It's something that I related to as a millennial entering the workforce during the Great Recession. And it's just like, what? I feel completely, entirely lost. So that's on a very short list to head to in the next couple of years. And I'll be sipping apricot brandy in the Café Flore someday soon.
Parlez-vous français?
Un peu.
You're practicing. I like it. I like it. We'll do a little Duolingo in our spare time. It's how we roll here. Oh my gosh, Brian. If you need more Brian Grover in your life like I do, you can find him on LinkedIn under a stack of books. Quite literally, it's a picture, a stack of books, and then it's a picture. So if you need book recommendations, if you need more to learn more about influencer, if you need content writer, if you need a content writer with Brian's very unique, lovely voice, reach out to him on LinkedIn for sure. What a joy, Brian. I'm so grateful.
Thank you so much for having me, Carrie. It was a pleasure.
And thank you to our listeners, Trevor. I see you, Steve Schmidt. Thank you, Nick Bennett. Thanks for popping on. Our listeners, going live, this is what it's all about. If you are listening after the fact, please be sure to like, subscribe, and share so you don't miss the next one. This episode is brought to you by MKG Marketing, our agency that fuels the mission of complex B2B tech brands ready to scale up via digital marketing strategy, SEO, and digital ads. It's hosted by me, Carrie Gard, CEO and co-founder of MKG Marketing. And if you'd like to be a guest, DM me. Let's chat. Let's hang out. I'm here for it. Look forward to meeting you all. Brian, thank you again.
Of course. Thanks, everyone. Take care.